This is the first day of this November 2018 7-day session. We'll go back to a text used in Taisho before, but not in a while, a book called Zen Dawn. And it's a collection of the earliest Zen texts, even predating Bodhidharma. And these texts were discovered in China in the famous Dunhuang Caves of northwest China. It's a desert environment. It's the edge of the Gobi Desert. And I just have to say, on one of my two pilgrimages to China, we went to the Dunhuang Caves, and it was maybe the most memorable part of that pilgrimage, partly because there were so few people up there. It hadn't been discovered yet by China's tourism industry. And elsewhere in China, what they call the holy mountains of China, Wutaishan, Ermeishan, Putoshan, those are the three we went to, three of the four, and it was just thronged with tourists. And this is even a long time ago. This was 35 years ago. Chinese government was just learning that they could bring in a lot of tourists and tourist dollars and marks and francs by restoring some of their pilgrimage, the Buddhist sites. But they hadn't yet got it together in the Dunhuang Cave, so it was a little hard to access these caves. We took a taxi, actually 8-hour taxi ride. Remember, it cost $100. 8-hour taxi ride across the corner of the Gobi Desert, and then arrived at these Dunhuang Caves. And it was so few people there, almost no one. We almost had it to ourselves, and learned that a British explorer, anthropologist and explorer by the name of Arnold Stein, had come across these caves in the 20th century, something like, I think, 1940 or 1950. And a monk there had shown him these caves with their thousands of scrolls, ancient scrolls that had been preserved in that arid desert climate for over 1,000 years. And also Buddha figures, other devotional figures. And Stein organized a great caravan, a caravan of camels, and made off with these thousands of scrolls and figures. I saw some of these figures and scrolls in the British Museum. In 1985, and just as a kind of a cultural aside, the Chinese government is understandably upset that these great cultural treasures of theirs were effectively stolen by Stein. But they were also preserved. They were protected because they were no longer when the Cultural Revolution happened between 1966 and 76, and the Red Guards went marauding, destroying Buddha figures and destroying not just a lot of Buddhist institutions, but also a lot of Chinese institutions, of the intellectuals, universities, and just a kind of a mass psychosis that happened. Well, these scrolls and figures had been removed, and so then now the rest of the world can appreciate these things. Anyway, this book, Zen Dawn, has some of the translations of those earliest scrolls. And the book was translated by J.C. Cleary. I'll just read a little bit of his introduction, Cleary's introduction. The three meditation manuals translated in this volume are among the earliest surviving records of Zen, or Chan, as it's known in China, Chan, Buddhism in China. These were long in oblivion in China itself. These three texts were rediscovered in the 20th century among the records of Tang dynasty civilization preserved at the Dunhuang in western China. These texts, the book is broken into these three texts. These texts date from the first half of the 8th century. So that's when the texts were written, apparently. But they record these masters from the 5th century. So the majority of the book is this section called Records of the Teachers and Students of the Lanka. And it begins with the original preface, or what's left of the original preface. The very first words in brackets are text broken off. And then this is what it says. It was evident that the great teacher Xuanzi, this is not the Confucian, the great Confucian legend Xuanzi, this is different spelling, slightly different spelling. It was evident that the great teacher Xuanzi had long since consummated the path. You know, what I love about this material is that it dates back to the 700s. That's where it was a direct translation from the 700s. So it has this wonderful, enthralling sense of being steeped in time, the deep roots of the Zen school of Buddhism, Chan. We think of Bodhidharma. He's credited as the founder of the Chan school, the Zen school. But here, this starts off with a couple of his predecessors, earlier teachers, starting with this Xuanzi. It says, in 708, he was called by imperial summons to the western capital. He taught the methods of Chan widely in the eastern capital. And then we hear that the author of this, the one who recorded this, in the 700s, is a monk by the name of Jing Jue. I, Jing Jue, was in his assembly and took refuge with him, serving him single-mindedly. Took refuge there, that means that this Xuanzi was a Buddhist master. Taking refuge is take refuge in the three treasures, as we do every day here in Sesshin. I take refuge in Buddha, I take refuge in Dharma, I take refuge in Sangha. It is the closest thing we have to an initiation ceremony, initiation as a member of the Buddha's family, the Dharma. And I took refuge with him, serving him single-mindedly. I traveled back and forth between the two capitals, practicing earnestly with him. the mental states that had appeared in me over the past several years were soon resolved. Again, it just leaves so much unknown, the mental states. What was it? Anxiety? Depression? Don't know. And then it says, among those to whom the great teacher Hongren had given predictions of enlightenment, there was one from Anzhou. This was my great teacher, again, Xuanzi. In appearance, he was like an ordinary monk, but in his realization, he shared the stage of the Buddhas. Well, if he had that kind of stature, if he had that depth of realization, you would expect him, in appearance, to be like an ordinary monk. Because what long Zen practice does is strip us down to the simplest of our essential humanity. The masters over time have over and over said, just be ordinary. Stop trying to be someone special. And this ordinariness, this simplicity, this transparency, this without affectation, this is what we'd ordinarily expect with someone of deep realization. And this monk, Jing Jue, continues, he was the imperial teacher, a national treasure to whom people throughout the land gave their allegiance. Since I had a causal link with him from past lives, I personally received his instructions. Only then did I come to know that the inner heart is fully endowed with true thusness. Things I had never before heard, I now found out. I love this sentence. Since I had a causal link with him from past lives, I personally received his instructions. The Buddha once answered a question about rebirth. And he said, if you want to know what you were in the past, look at yourself now. If you want to know what you'll be in the future, look at yourself now. This monk, Jing Jue, just seems to take it for granted that, of course, the people we are closest to here are people we have known before this lifetime. Just a moment's reflection of that offers to endow with enormous significance all of our relationships, especially our closest relationships. Here, the 51 of us here in this room, consider we've all known each other from previous lives. A lot of people won't buy this. It seems so easy to accept, so really sensible, that so much more sensible than to think that death is an ending. That everything is cyclical. Nothing ends. Matter is neither created nor destroyed, but changes in form. So we keep getting for those of us who do believe in rebirth, and I have no doubt of it, we keep getting another chance. Here we are with probably our best chance, that is the environment, the institution of Sesshin, our best chance of changing, reforming ourselves. When he says, "Only then did I come to know that the inner heart is fully endowed with true thusness," it sounds like he's talking about having had an awakening to that. Things I'd never before heard, I now found out. Now as we go on, I'm going to skip some paragraphs here. He gets extremely philosophical, he gets very conceptual, which is hard enough when you're reading it. It's even harder assimilating it when it's read aloud to you. So some of this, I think, is just too much to handle as spoken teaching. But here he says, now he's presenting himself as a kind of teacher, which is fair enough. We all can teach out of our experience. People still sometimes ask about that, and it's important that whatever we've experienced, we can pass on to others. We don't have to be shy about that. If someone at work who's found out that you do Zen meditation, asks you to show them how to sit, well, show them. You know how. Help them out. Give them this great treasure, Zen practice. The danger is in trying to sell it, but just to respond to a sincere interest in it, then that's something beyond the actual method of sitting, which everyone here can pass on to other people. Beyond the method, that's when there's more of a risk. If you start talking about the Dharma, then that's something else again. But showing people how to sit, it's not just a right that we have, it's almost a obligation, provided it's someone who really does, is seriously asking about it. And then if you do show someone to sit, then let it go. Don't want to then be hovering over them and asking them how it's going and making a big thing of it. Once they've been shown, then it's their karma, whether they pursue it. We find this out in introductory workshops at the Zen Center. You show people how to sit. You talk about Zen practice, the method, how to do it, how to use the mind, how to use your attention. And then it's pretty much out of our hands. For some people, it'll take. A lot of people, it won't. And here he speaks out of presumably his experience. He says, what is called the reality nature of mind, and this is the translator's choice of what others have translated as the true nature, the essential nature of mind. I think reality nature is a little bit awkward, so maybe I'll substitute some of these other ones, these more commonly used ones like essential nature. What is called the essential nature of mind is neither born nor destroyed. There. It's a good opening statement. Our essential nature is beyond birth and death. He says there are distinctions among all phenomena only based on false thoughts. The forms of objects do not exist separately apart from the mind's thoughts. Therefore, from the beginning, all things are detached from the forms of language, detached from the forms of names, and detached from the forms of mental objects. They are ultimately equal, without change, and indestructible. They are just the one mind. Hence the name true thusness. He's making the point that even as things are things because of mind, as we say in the Affirming Faith of Mind, things are things because of mind. The fact, if they didn't have names for them, it doesn't mean they wouldn't exist. We assign names to things. Cushion, tree, Ralph, Jason, cheese. But it's just the finger pointing at the moon. It's not the moon itself. It's not the reality. It's just a designation. It's an agreed upon word. Again, he says there are distinctions among all phenomena only based on false thoughts. By that he means just our conventional assignments of terms. He says, moreover, the inherent essential being of true thusness is neither augmented nor diminished in ordinary people, shravakas, bodhisattvas, or buddhas. He's just, without getting into all those, he's talking about the different degrees of understanding or lack of understanding. No matter what we've come to realize through practice, there's no essential difference in our essential nature. We are all equally endowed with this essential nature, this enlightened nature, originally enlightened nature. He says, it is neither born in the past nor destroyed in the future. Ultimately, it endures forever. From its fundamental nature, it is self-sufficient in all virtues. In its own essential being, it has the light of great wisdom. Thus, it is the pure mind of inherent reality. Well, it's one thing to hear this, to comprehend it conceptually. Sounds good. It's sometimes I say to people, it's sort of the doctrine of original sin turned upside down. It's the doctrine of original enlightenment, wisdom, bodhi. It's another thing to really grasp it experientially. And that's one reason we're here this week. Is to do that, to confirm this Dharma through our experience. He goes on, the Lankavatara Sutra says, inherent mind manifests objects appearing everywhere amid the five phenomena according to kind. And then this monk says, what are the five phenomena? Names, forms, false thinking, he already mentioned those, true wisdom and thusness. For this reason, all things are nameless. They are named by mind. All forms are formless. They are given form by mind. It's a Buddha figures, just to mention one form, that the figure of the Buddha, Zen Master Hakuin said, Buddhas in reality have no form, but they are given form out of our necessity, saying much the same. Buddha, the phrase Buddha nature or essential nature would be so abstract without a form, the figure of the Buddha. It's a concession to human needs. But essentially there's no form. Or it's all forms, this Buddha nature. And he says, just be no-minded oneself, and there are no names or forms. Then it is called true wisdom and thusness. So then he goes back to the autobiographical. He said, so I immersed my spirit in dark silence and nurtured my real identity on remote cliffsides, holding solely to the mind of purity, preserving oneness until it filled the valleys. That's our assignment this week. Holding solely to the mind of purity, which just means holding to nothing whatever, but dwelling in Prajna wisdom. Non-clinging, that's holding to the mind of purity. It's also confirms the non-differentiation of all forms. He says, composing a preface, that's this what we're reading from, this is the preface, I lodge my enlightenment within it in the hope that those who share in the stream of our path will come to know mind. Capital M. The wondrous essence of true thusness is not apart from birth and death. The abstruse subtlety of the path of the sages lies within the body of form. The purity of the body of form is lodged amid afflictions. The inherent reality of birth and death is provisionally located in nirvana. You see what he's doing here is insisting that these dualistic terms we have, form and emptiness, nirvana and the world of samsara, birth and death, so forth, these are all just words we give to things, that we can get underneath the level of language, then things are simply non-dual. Thus we know that sentient beings in these old texts always means the so-called unenlightened. Thus we know that sentient beings and Buddha nature share a common identity. They are like water and ice. What difference is there in their essential being? The solid barrier of ice represents the bondage of sentient beings, whereas water by nature energizes and flows through. It is equivalent to the perfect purity of Buddha nature. So we just, half an hour ago, we together recited the Hakuin chant, and in there he says, like water and ice, without water, no ice, outside us, no Buddhas. So this is not original. This is not something that Hakuin came up with on his own. He's drawing from these ancient texts. It's a marvelous analogy, water and ice. Even if we are blocked like ice, still the essential nature of ice is water, and we can thaw and restore this fluidity, this adaptability that is our nature, this non-attachment. We don't have to get it somewhere. We don't have to go out and learn how to be fluid or adaptable, harmonious. We just have to melt this blocked psyche of ours through Zazen. He continues, there is nothing that can be attained, no form that can be sought. Even good things are dispensed with, so birth and death must be left far behind. That is, ideas of birth and death. Then he quotes the Vimalakirti Sutra. If one would attain the perfection of purity, one must purify one's mind. As one's mind is purified, so the Buddha land is purified. And then he says, though physical existence is the basis for them, consciousness and perception range from shallow to deep. As for profound perceptions, they are pure through the ages. They are the basis to influence and cultivate mind from the first generation of the aspiration for enlightenment until the achievement of Buddhahood without falling back. As for shallow consciousness, this is what new students today have. Although they are delighted at the outset, they lack the power to practice the path with correct faith, owing to slanderous and twisted views accumulated for lifetimes. Slanderous? I don't know about that. Twisted, maybe. Owing to twisted views accumulated for lifetimes. Since the basis is not firm, later they fall back in defeat. The word twisted reminds me of another translation of what we use as the repentance gata. We say, all harmful actions committed by me since time immemorial, and so forth. Another translation of that, I think used at the San Francisco Zen Center, was all ancient twisted karma. That gets to it, doesn't it? In Sesshin, we are reintroduced to this ancient twisted karma of the mind, the body-mind. And then another profound statement. He says, repeatedly undergoing birth and death is just due to grasping at objects. So this life of samsara, this life of suffering physically, suffering emotionally, it's just due to grasping at objects. Well, what objects? What objects are we always grasping at? Well, of course, thoughts, mental objects. It's not just other things, grasping at food, grasping at sex, grasping at money. Those are nothing compared to thoughts. clinging to thoughts, grasping at thoughts, pursuing thoughts, trafficking in thoughts. Through Zen practice, we have a way to learn through training the mind to not do those things, or little by little to do less of them. When we reflect back on the mind that grasps at objects, we see that the real identity of mind is originally pure. Within this purity, grasping mind really does not exist. So first he says the problem is grasping at objects, and he says that in our essential nature, grasping mind really does not exist. It does not exist as anything of substance to it. It's just habit energy. Habit energy of grasping, clinging, trafficking, pursuing thoughts. Within the peaceful extinction of nirvana, fundamentally there are no thoughts moving. The movement is ever still. Again, back to the Hakuin chant, our thought now being no thought. It's not that we can induce a coma through Zen practice. It's just that by not grasping at the thoughts as they arise, they are like no thoughts. They're not a problem. It's just a certain kind of biological thing that happens, thoughts arising in the mind. And if we don't attend to them, then it's as if they're not there. And he says, being still, there is no seeking. Where the thoughts are is ever real. Being real, where the thoughts are is ever real. Being real, there are no defilements or attachments. Having no defilements is purity. Having no bonds is liberation. Defilement is the basis of birth and death. Purity is the fruit of enlightenment. There is no Dharma that can be explained, no mind that can be spoken of. Inherent reality nature, essential nature, is empty. Going back to the fundamental basis, it is the path, the way. The real identity of the way is empty and boundless, vast and pure. With its stillness and solitude, it obliterates the cosmos. It pervades ancient and modern, but its nature is pure. It is perfect from top to bottom and everywhere pure. This is the pure Buddha land. You know, what may sound to some of you as just a whole lot of puzzling words, you can really confirm it this week in Sesshin, especially later, more commonly, when we see that this essential mind of ours is indeed still, silent. He quotes a sutra. The path of enlightenment cannot be charted or measured. Highest of the high, vast beyond limit, deepest of the deep, profound beyond fathoming, big enough to contain heaven and earth, small enough to enter an infinitesimal point. Thus it is called the path. And then he goes on to speak a lot about existence and non-existence. This too, I think, is too much for people to, especially on the first day of Sesshin, to absorb this. And then he ends this preface by quoting another sutra. This is the Light Emitting Perfection of Wisdom Sutra. He says, is enlightenment attained from being? No. Is it attained from nothingness? No. Is it attained from being and nothingness? No. Is it attained apart from being and nothingness? No. What does this mean? There is nothing attained. Attaining without attainment is called attaining enlightenment. There's nothing attained. As we say in the Prajnaparamita, attainment too is emptiness. The great promise of Zen practice is to realize nothing. Realize the nothing that is not apart from things. Tomorrow we'll take up the first of these masters who preceded Bodhidharma. But now we'll stop and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to meditate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain.